ladies and gentlemen, our first case for argument is Scott against Chuhak and Texan. Mr. Gold.
May it please the court. We ask this court to reverse the district court and its rulings relative to its interpretation of the protective order in place, its summary judgment against the plaintiff, its 12B6 ruling, and as well as its ruling with respect to our motion to compel. This record contains many instances of error committed by the district court. Indeed, the district court, we believe, not only misinterpreted the protective order in place, but abused its discretion in the sanctions that it assessed against me and my client for having allegedly violated the protective order in place. I ask this court to take a look again in its deliberations of the protective order that was entered into the parties. Specifically, there's nothing in that protective order that required the sharing of what was designated by every document produced by the defendant in this case, defendants in this case, as privileged, from sharing those documents with the attorneys for plaintiff.
Well, there was a restriction. It was for only for purposes of prosecution or defense of this litigation.
That is correct.
That's a pretty clear restriction.
Well, it is a restriction which says that you can only use these documents for the prosecution of the case before Judge Guzman.
Right.
All right. Now, as this record indicates, and I'm sure this court recognizes, the corporate representative for the defendant in this case was lead counsel for the trustee in the state court case. And all of the information, I mean, it was always contemplated by the district court that we should share this information to avoid duplicative costs and unnecessary repetition of discovery.
True, but not to ignore privileges, not to ignore the attorney-client privilege.
The issue of attorney-client privileges
There was a protective order.
I'm sorry?
That's why there was a protective order, because there were privileged matters.
Well,
Stang represents Diane in the state court litigation.
Right.
She has a privilege which is at issue in this protective order. And the firm has
Very
a duty
good.
To protect that privileged information.
Well, Stang has...
Now, if your concern is were too many documents marked privileged, that's
right.
Something you should have taken up with the district judge.
No. What I'm suggesting, Judge, is that the privilege that you've specified, the attorney-client privilege between Stang and his client in the state court, Diane, that information, whatever communications existed between Stang and Diane, never surfaced in any of the documents that were produced by the defendant in the federal litigation. Okay? Nothing between Stang and Diane. The only communications, indeed, that were produced were continuous communications between myself, Mr. Flaherty, and Mr. Stang relative to the attempt to share this information in accordance with the request being made of us at the very first status hearing by Judge Guzman. So there was no, indeed, I think a month into the litigation, after the first status hearing, and I think it was January 6th of 2010, all of the parties receive a letter from a lawyer at the Chuikin Tyson containing all of the communications between Chuikin Tyson and their clients and my client, all right, relative to various trusts, which is further evidence of the intent of the parties that everything be shared so that we don't duplicate the discovery efforts in both cases.
Well, that doesn't change the protective order.
It doesn't change the protective order because the protective order does not say, it does not say that it must be shared for with only attorneys of record in the federal case. The protective order specifically says that this information can be shared with the attorneys for the party. Now, the lawyers representing Minor Scott in the state court were his attorneys.
Mr. Gold, I'm getting worried that you seem to be emphasizing your own interest at the expense of your client's interests.
What is my interest?
The main issue on this appeal concerns right. your client's interests, and it seems to me you should be discussing them.
That's true. Well, I mean, I'm just responding, Your Honor, I'm just responding
you
to...
You began with your own interests. I'm suggesting that you now discuss your client's interests.
My client's interest, Judge, is that the district court be reversed. My client's interest...
That's your conclusion. I wish you to make a legal argument.
Okay. The legal argument, Judge, I've made relative to the district court's interpretation of the protective order, which led to the sanctions that prevented us from taking depositions in the case, which I think is an abuse of discretion and damaging to my clients. The bottom line is, and the record is undisputed, that back in, I believe it was 2004, my client, my client's decedent, retained Chuikin Tyson. That what was called in their own document, harmonize her estate with the estate of her father. And it was done. And I'm talking now to the merits of the motion for summary judgment. At the point in time when Milton Kiefer dies, at that juncture, an inherent conflict existed between Chuikin Tyson's representation of Diane.
That's not very unusual to be asked to do the whole family.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Family. That happens all the time.
All the time. It's not unusual.
Everybody's confronted with that, I think.
There is no question about it. That
is. You're trying to make a whole big deal out of the whole thing, but I'm not sure that it merits that kind of attention.
Well, let me say this to you. What happens all the time, Your Honor, is that estate planning lawyers are called upon to plan the estate of a family. And that's what happens all the time. And I'm not suggesting to this court that there's any conflict in Chuikin Tyson drafting all of the estate planning documents for the entire family. What I'm suggesting is that once the grantor in this case, Milton Kiefer dies, with an estate of approximately $60 million. At that juncture, there is or might be a conflict of the lawyers who represent the trustee and the estate and the beneficiaries. Those lawyers have a fiduciary obligation, and the law is quite clear, to both the trustee, and the beneficiaries. In this case, based upon this record that's before this court, at no time was the potential for a conflict or the suggestion made by the Chuick firm to my client, to Maureen when she was alive, as well as to her husband, who is now the administrator of her estate, that they may want to seek independent counsel because of a potential for conflict. And we claim, Your Honor, that what happened here is that conflict raised its ugly head because of the fact that, based upon the allegations and the documentation that we have so far in this record, Diane Shaw, the trustee, had the benefit of accessing funds during Maureen's lifetime of her father's estate that was never explained to my client's decedent. I meant to say that Diane had access. Maureen was never explained by her lawyers, the same lawyers, of her ability to obtain those assets, which we believe and we claim and we want the opportunity to prove damaged her estate and her children. And that conflict, we believe, is so clear under our rules of professional conduct and under the facts of this case that it warrants reversal of the district court's finding on summary judgment. Indeed.
What do you say about this conference that they had where they could have asked a lot of questions if they wanted to?
Right.
I don't know, what more do you have to do than that?
Well, it's interesting, Judge, that the expert retained by Chuick and Tyson, in her deposition, clearly states, and in a given situation such as this, where the lawyers represent both the trustee and the beneficiaries, and I think we quoted it in some of our papers that we've filed with this court, Ellen Trust says that a one-sentence explanation of the rights, for example, of Maureen under her separate trust in this kind of a situation is insufficient. And that's all there was on this chart that the defense says was sufficient to adequately inform these beneficiaries of their rights under the various trusts. Indeed, if you take a look at what Magistrate Keyes said in his decision relative to not only the apparent conflict, but the inconsistencies and perhaps misrepresentation, and this is not me, this is Judge Keyes stating that the defendants wrote a letter saying that there was a separate trust created for Maureen upon the death of Milton, which was required by the trust documents, and then subsequently the defendants in this case say no such trust was ever created. And those are not my words, Your Honor. Those are the words
now
of...
Now you say the death of Ruth. Ruth is still alive.
No, well, actually, she's deceased now. No, but...
she wasn't when this case was
No,
tried.
No, but that letter was referencing the Milton's death and that a separate trust for Maureen was created upon Milton's death, which just was not true. And they said that in writing. I would like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal unless you all have questions. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Gold.
Thank you.
Clarity.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Michael Flaherty on behalf of the Chuhak firm and the individual lawyers from that firm who were sued in this case, Mr. Gold. Your Honors, one of the things that struck me when I was preparing for the argument today is that the decisions of Judge Guzman with respect to his interpretations of the various trusts that are involved in this case hasn't been challenged at all on appeal. And I would suggest to you that that ends the case. This really is a situation where the trust documents that establish the Kiever estate plan control what happened here, and they were followed. And there's no suggestion that they weren't followed. The bulk of the money that was held in the Kiever estates was Milton Kiever's money, if you will, transferred from his living trust to the marital trust on his death. The Kievers accumulated a vast amount of money in their lifetime. I don't know whether the daughters were aware of that before Milton Kiever died or not, but I do know that the daughters were aware of that within a month of his death when they went to a meeting with their accountant and with the lawyers from the Chuhak firm and with Ruth. Ruth at that time was the trustee of the marital trust, and Ruth made books and records of family money and the various trusts known to her daughters during that meeting. That level of disclosure was at a fiduciary level of disclosure that hasn't even been challenged. And that level of disclosure, that was the role, if you will, that Chuhak had in that meeting, was assisting its client, Ruth, in making that level of disclosure. If we look at what actually occurred in that context, Your Honors, they ended up with a chart, and the chart explained the various trusts that were there, including powers of appointment with respect to certain matters. I point that out because one of the document that dealt with all of the money that was in the marital trust that would make its way to the family trust, actually discusses power of appointment in exactly the same way that the Milton Grantor Trust discusses power of appointment. Within a month following that meeting, there was a letter that was sent by Mr. Margolin to Maureen Scott and to Diane. That letter informed each of them of the possibility that if they survived their mothers, that the money would then make its way to the family trust, and from the family trust it would be divided equally between them. And that really is the bulk of what I think caused this whole litigation to begin with in the first place, because that's where all the money is. There is a note that Mr. Scott testified at his deposition that Maureen Scott purportedly made on that letter. And that note said something to the effect of, you can even read it to you. That note said, "Steve, I want this done, Maureen K. Scott." And that's the letter that's the May 3rd, 2006 letter that's in the record. There's an argument, I think, that exists over whether her intention with that was with respect to Section 3.4A of the trust and saying that she simply wanted to be named as her own trustee, or whether it meant that she wanted something more than that with respect to a power of appointment. None of that matters. That money that we're talking about that's in that trust is money that never drops to her level because she dies before her mother does. But what we do know is that communication that occurred within a couple of weeks after or prior to her death occurred at a time where she's already signed her will, and her will's already dealt with the power of appointment, and her will flags for her that there is no power of appointment that's going on in this will. At no time does she communicate to the Chuhak firm that it is her goal to have any sort of power of appointment occur with respect to any of her trusts. Now, the reality of it is, if she had made that request, there's only one trust that would have had a power of appointment that could have been implicated. And that was the Grantor Trust that had itself set up a contingent marital trust. That Grantor Trust was in place to basically clean up all the tax matters. And to the extent there was money that was going to be taxed, instead of taxing it, it would shove it back into Ruth's pocket as a contingent marital trust so that it wouldn't be taxed.
Didn't Maureen have the right to request discretionary disbursements from that trust?
She actually had the right, and she was told that she had the right with respect to all of these trusts to make requests for discretionary income. The trust that she would have probably made that request from was the trust where all the money was, not the trust that was set up to take care of the tax issues. And the trust where all the money was the marital trust. And we know, in fact, that she did make a request to that because they borrowed $475,000 from that trust through Ruth. That dollar amount was forgiven. That debt was forgiven upon Maureen's death. But that's, again, Your Honor raises a good point. That's just a discretion. That's not a right. That gives the trustee the discretion. Doesn't give Maureen any discretion. Gives the trustee the discretion to make the disbursement. If there had been money in the scrape over separate trust that came into that trust so that it was literally there, she could have made a request as against that trust for a loan. I agree with that. And that would have allowed her to make a request for a loan up to her share of that trust during that time, which would have been about $400,000. But we know that she never made that request. We know that the document says that she has those rights, the chart too. But beyond that, that money then at her after the IRS issues its closing letter, that $400,000 goes to her children because she's dead at that point. And so the intent of Milton Keever in the estate planning documents that any money that's his makes it to his direct descendants actually is fulfilled. We know of nothing that would suggest that she ever thought with respect to that trust that she needed to do something differently than what was done. And the fact that it ended up going to her children is something that I don't know if there's a reason that she would have done anything to the contrary, even if she'd wanted to. Miner Scott actually testified at his deposition, oh, if that money that was in that trust, if she'd asked me what she should do about it, I would have told her it should go to the kids. This isn't really about that trust. This is about how do I get my hands on that $60 million. The real problem here is that Miner Scott left that meeting with his wife following his father-in-law's death, thinking that they had $30 million. All they had to do was Maureen had to outlive Ruth. His only questions were about who's managing the money. He admits as much. Those are the issues on that, and I would suggest that, Your Honors, the interpretation of those trust documents was followed literally. Now, I'd like to address some of the points that Mr. Gold raised in response to Your Honor's questions. The protective order itself was in place because of that other litigation. My clients had duties to their clients in respect to that other litigation. In that other litigation, those clients are being sued for essentially the same things that my client's being sued for. They're being blamed as trustees as opposed to my client being blamed as the lawyer. There was never any effort to say that any of the documents that were disclosed shouldn't have been marked privileged. We disclosed 10,000 documents. They concerned one window of time, and it's, I believe, the only window of time that's important. That's from the death of Milton to the death of Maureen. And everything that they sought in their motion to compel wasn't about that time. It was about after Maureen died. Maureen's estate has no interest in any transfers that would have occurred after her death. This case is a fishing expedition. That's all it ever was. It's an effort to try to get money. It's an effort to try to leverage an attorney-client relationship between my clients and theirs, and they wanted access to my clients' communications. Now, they tried to take issue with the fact that Mr. Stang was the corporate representative. The plaintiffs never disclosed any documents as privileged matter. They never made an objection during Mr. Scott's deposition on any question as it dealing with privilege where it would be inappropriate for Mr. Stang to be there. Of course, Mr. Stang's documents with his clients concerning the litigation weren't produced by us. They weren't in that window of time. Magistrate Keyes ruled that window of time is the only window that's important. As for the discussions with the expert opinions, I believe that Mr. Merrick's opinion should have been stricken in total. They were not supported by any facts or evidence. They were supported by looking at the allegations of the complaint and Mr. Gold telling him they're true. Well, we know that the allegations of the complaint were false, at least with respect to all of the information that was shared with Maureen Scott. If you look at the allegations of the complaint, she would have never gotten that chart. She would have never known about any of those trusts. And that's just false. The allegations that were in the complaint, standing alone, were contradicted by undisputed evidence. And I believe that it would have been appropriate to strike all of his opinions on that basis. But he also had no substantive opinions. No opinions at all as respects anything that my clients did that deviated from their standard of care as lawyers in this case. To the extent they want to try to make an issue out of the disparate interests between Diane and Ruth, I'm sorry, between Diane and Maureen, there were no disparate interests. None. They each, during their lifetimes, assuming they outlived their mother, would have split $60 million equally. If either one of them took a loan from their side of the equation, as Eileen Trost explains in her expert disclosures, that's simply an investment that the trust is making with respect to a matter that comes out of their side of the $30 million, or their side of the $60 million. There was no disparate interest between these two sisters at all. The only disparity that's occurred now is because Minor Scott has a disparate interest with his own children. They're the ones that are inheriting $30 million. And he's trying to figure out how to get his hands on some of it. And I suggest, Your Honor, that's all this case is about. Judge Goodsman's order was a summary judgment was proper. As to an abuse of discretion, certain points were argued. As to an abuse of discretion, discovery cut off 4 days early. But it just didn't cut off 4 days early. It resulted from this dispute that occurred during the deposition of Minor Scott. And during that, in the days succeeding that deposition, we had scheduled the depositions of my client. I offered at that deposition of Minor Scott that I would produce my clients for their depositions in the following 2 days. I was still going to go forward on my motion for sanctions, but I would produce them. I had one qualification. I wanted Mr. Gold to be the lawyer in the room that was asking the questions when there were issues relating to the privileged matters that were at issue in this case. I said that I will raise objections if they come to privileged matters. If they do, Mr. Fleming can excuse himself. If they don't, I was going to let him stay in the room. And Mr. Gold refused. And he refused because he really wanted more discovery time. We were like a week, 2 weeks short of the discovery cutoff. And this was a mechanism for that he was hoping he was going to get additional time. But let's talk about the sanction. He says the sanction's abuse of discretion. At the actual argument before Judge Guzman with respect to when the sanction was occurring, Mr. Gold requested that the sanction be...
It's necessary to continually point to your opposing...
I'm sorry, Your Honor. Mr. Gold suggested that the sanction that would be appropriate would be to just cut off his ability to depose my clients. And frankly, their depositions were never necessary. This is a case that concerns trust documents. What do they say? Were they followed? And I think it's indisputed that the documents say what they say. Judge Guzman interpreted them correctly. There's no contest over that. So I believe that summary judgment should be sustained. I'd be happy to address any other questions that the court may have.
I don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Gold?
I don't know how my opponent would know what was in my head as to additional time at that deposition. I wanted to go over to Judge Guzman and straighten the whole thing out. And Mr. Stang and my opponent refused to do so relative to the interpretation, which I believe was accurate of the protective order. In any event, the defense portrays this situation as one where my client, Minor Scott, wants to get his hands on $30 million. He's a bad guy. And the allegations in the complaint are false. Well, I would like the opportunity to have the trier of fact decide that. I would like to have the opportunity, Your Honors, to allow the trier of fact to determine whether these lawyers, given the situation, given the fact that they were retained initially by Maureen Scott at a time when she was living, and indeed there was in place in the documentation, what was designated in the record as a loan repayment plan. The loan repayment plan being that Diane Shaw had borrowed something like $2.5 to $3 million from the various trusts of her father to purchase a condominium in New York. Now, as we've alleged in the complaint, had Maureen been advised by her then lawyers, the Chuick firm, that she had the same rights to borrow and to access the funds of her father, she could have borrowed some of the money that her sister borrowed and utilized that for her business in Colorado, which would have resulted in the savings of hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not more, in expenses and interest for loans that she had to make from other sources. The statements by the defense in its oral argument that the trust documents were accurately followed and that we have not contested Judge Guzman's interpretation of the trust documents is just not accurate. We do. The fact of the matter is that my opponent refers to the marital trust and the money that was borrowed from the marital trust of $465,000. The real trust that's at issue that we never had the opportunity to present to the trier fact was the Milton Grantor Trust, and upon his death, a separate trust being set up for Maureen, which we believe at that juncture, based upon the assets that were available, would have been approximately $2 million at that time. And we were told, or Maureen was told through her daughter, that a separate trust was set up upon Milton's death. That letter to Maureen's daughter was not obtained until after Maureen's death. Maureen was never told during her lifetime that there was a separate trust, this grantor, her separate individual trust, was never disclosed by her lawyers, the Chuick firm, during her lifetime. It was only after she died that her husband Minor opened up the estate and, as this record demonstrates, attempted on many occasions to get the documents from the Chuick firm as to what transpired. He hired lawyers in Colorado and even lawyers in Illinois to find out where the trust documents are. It was at that juncture that finally his daughter made a request of the Chuick firm, what's going on, and they write her that letter saying upon her mother's death, her separate grantor trust was set up. That letter is just false. That's what's false. And even Judge Keyes pointed that out. That's key, because if indeed the Chuick firm had complied with the trust documents, or at least advised their client, Maureen, maybe you ought to get another lawyer, then the trust may have been set up. She could have had the benefit of that trust and the monies that would have been placed in there, or should have been. With respect to the argument by the defense that, well, the trustees didn't have to make disbursements from the other trust. We're not even talking about that separate grantor trust that was never set up for Maureen upon Milton's death. The other trusts that were in play had this...
Counsel.
I'm sorry, am I through?
Your time has expired.
Okay, then I'm through. Thank you, Your Honors.
The case is taken under advisement. Our second...